Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Running a household is a huge task, and in a two-parent house, it can also be a source of frustration and stress. That's where the fair play method comes in. Creator Eve Rodsky joins us to talk about how it works and how you and your partner can implement this way of thinking in your life. It includes a card game too. Then, a goal to make financial literacy for our kids a priority. Tim Renzetta, co-founder of Next Gen Personal Finance, talks about Mission 2030, a plan to ensure that every high school student in the U.S. will take a semester-long personal finance course by the time they graduate, and how self-esteem and money go hand in hand. Financial therapist and coach Aya Evans is going to be here to talk about how she works with her clients to navigate issues around self-esteem. Plus, I'll speak with Sasha Kakuz, CEO of private equity firm Greybrook, about how they invest in large-scale real estate developments on behalf of individuals. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. The first thing I think of when I think of investing in real estate is some sort of an income property, right? Like, I don't know, I'm going to have a rental somewhere. And then I think, I don't want to do that because I'm going to fix the faucets and deal with a tenant. But there are other ways to get into this game. And so we're going to talk about one that is, it's actually a private equity firm that offers a way for individuals to invest in real estate, but where they don't have to have a plumber's certificate and answer phone calls at 3 a.m. Greybrook is the name of the firm. Its CEO, Sasha Chuchus, joins us now from Toronto to talk about how it works. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I know a lot of people have a real interest in the real estate sector as an asset class in their overall investing mix. Like me, they don't want to have a traditional rental. You provide an alternative. How does that work?
Yeah, so you said it in your opening. We consume real estate in a different way. So most people do so, as you mentioned, by way of an income stream. They think of it like buying a finished product and you're extracting cash flow from that product. We're like the manufacturer of the product. So we invest in development, primarily residential development, and it's just a different way for investors to get exposure to a different part of the real estate continuum.
And is the bet about the capital appreciation in the real estate, or is it about the income stream, or is it both?
The way we do it, it's typically capital appreciation. So what investors are looking for is really a way to multiply their money over time. And if you think about it, it's a margin-based business. Development, not unlike, you know, the proverbial economic example of a widget. You know, there's a cost to acquire the raw materials, that in our case being land and all of the input costs of building a residence, whether it be a condominium or a large-scale housing development. And at the end of the day, the consumer is ultimately the one who's buying to live in it or to rent it, that investor. And we're making our money on the margin, and that's how our investors multiply their wealth.
How do you think about time horizon and investment return? And I know, I'm sure there's 12,000 compliance reasons why you can't be super specific and nothing is guaranteed because the past doesn't foreshadow the future and all that. But with a traditional mutual fund, in Canadian equities, we have some framework for what that could equal over the course of a 5 to 10 year time horizon. Is there a way to provide a comparable based on your history with your investments?
Yeah, of course. So historically, our performance is, again, you know, to all with all of the disclaimers that are there, has been tracking to kind of a 20% annualized return. And that's kind of our target for the investments that we make. So net of all of the associated sort of profit splits and fees, investors would make a net 20% per annum. It's not paid out annually, because if you think about what we're doing is we're buying a piece of land, we're putting a hole in the ground, we're building something. And at the end of the day, we realize our profit when people ultimately move in and we close on those units. So it equates to about a 20% annualized return. The timeframe can vary depending on what phase of the development we get ourselves involved in. For example, if we buy a property that's approved and ready to go with all of the permits in place, and we're participating mainly in the construction, the sales and construction of that building, that could be a 4-year project time horizon. In other instances where we get involved buying what I call raw land, so land that's already entitled, but there's still a lot of zoning that needs to be done and other planning work, design, and so on and so forth, that process can take anywhere between 5 and 7 years. So all of our investors will know at the onset for each project what our forecasted timelines are and what the expected rates of return are.
You can buy a unit of a mutual fund for a very small amount. I mean, $500 and you're in the game. What does it take to be a qualified investor for these investments, for what you're dealing?
Right. So we tend to keep our minimums low relative to most private equity vehicles. So not like a mutual fund where you can buy it for $500, but our minimums are around $25,000. In terms of the qualification of an investor, our product is geared specifically mostly towards, I'd say, accredited investors. So there's a, you know, regulatory definition of that, but it's for people that generally have, you know, a certain amount of financial wealth already in place. We also can accept a category of investor called eligible investor. So that pretty much covers everybody. And we just have to be very careful about, you know, concentration limits and liquidity and things like that. But our team is equipped to be able to work with people to determine the right strategy and the right level of investment for our product.
How do you achieve diversification? So if I did buy that rental property, I'd have one rental property and there could be a whole bunch of issues that could befall that investment. How do you handle diversification for your investors?
That's a great question. So there's really multiple ways. We invest in a variety of different types of development. So as you can imagine, for those of your listeners that are in the Toronto area, for example, or Southern Ontario, you know, a townhouse development is going to have very different characteristics than a condo development in the middle of Toronto. So we achieve diversification both by what we call product type. So single family housing, multifamily housing, condominium, and so forth. We achieve diversification through geography. So we invest throughout Southern Ontario, as well as in multiple markets in the United States. And we achieve diversification through operators. So in all of our investments, we make the investment with an execution partner who's a large-scale developer. And we work with about 10 different large-scale developers, all of whom would be household names for those that are paying attention to this industry. So there's multiple levels of diversification. And then we always try to encourage people. Typically, when people hear about us, they might see a specific project and say, wow, I really want to invest in that project. We try to encourage people, sure, you can invest in that project, but let's take whatever quantum is appropriate for you and put it into 4, 5, 6 different projects so that you can achieve diversification across all of those different areas.
With traditional equity investing, we know there are risks. There's stock market risk, there's interest rate risk, stuff a company inside of a fund can blow up. What are some of the risks that you would want investors to be aware of before they invested with you?
In our product, I mean, like anything in private equity, there's risk in different ways. I would characterize the two largest as illiquidity being one of them, because if one of the things you're doing, you have a forecasted timeline to your housing development or condo development, but there can be delays. There can be delays either in the planning and approvals process. There could be delays in the construction process and so on and so forth. So what we try to do is really have people understand that this isn't a liquid product. So you have to be comfortable with that. And then I think that the second thing, if I could characterize it, is just, you know, in terms of your operators, right? Like, I mean, I think the biggest thing, whether you're investing in equities, whether you're investing in bonds, whether you're investing in a product like ours, it's really doing your diligence in who the execution is. Because a business plan is one thing, a strategy is another thing. How you execute that and how competent your execution is, I would say is the single largest risk that people should really assess.
Where some people will have some skepticism, and certainly I have some skepticism based on what I knew growing up in the 80s about some of the real estate oriented schemes that were around in that time. Other people have been subjected to timeshares, which I know is not at all what you're talking about. It just involves real estate in a very, very different way. As you try and discern between what you do and the integrity and the credibility of it and other scam type things that are in the broad real estate world, how would you help people distinguish between the two? What are the warning signs or the red flags over here that you'd say, hey, wait, we're not like that. That's not what we do.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things at the corporate level. We're a registrant of the Ontario Securities Commission, as well as every other securities commission across Canada, and we're a registrant in good standing. So, we adhere to all of the different securities laws. We have a very robust compliance framework. I think that's a very important thing. So a lot of times when somebody's, showing you a presentation, if they don't have all of the documentation, a full offering memorandum, and open the kimono, so to speak, to use a cliche, in terms of diligence, whatever it takes, come visit the office, talk to people, do your diligence, look on the internet. So the credibility of the organization, I think, is one thing. And then the second thing is with regard to the strategy. This is something that might not, as you pointed out, it's not the most mainstream strategy. But if you think about, the amount of development, for example, in Southern Ontario that's taken place, there's been a lot of wealth that's been created through that process. And frankly, for most investors, it's just a question of awareness. It's about learning and understanding all of the different things out there. And zeroing in on quality means doing your work, doing the diligence, asking for the track record, doing your research. And it all comes back to that. It all comes back to execution.
How do you get paid? Canadian investors are quite used to looking at the management expense ratio on a mutual fund. Those people who know about hedge funds might know 2 and 20. How do you get paid?
Yeah, so 2 and 20, you mentioned 2 and 20. It's a typical private equity structure. In terms of quantum of fee-based compensation, it's about the same. It's structured differently because of the way a development is equitized at the beginning and how it all works. But generally speaking, we make our money in two ways. There's a sort of a base management fee that's taken throughout the course of the project. And it's usually somewhere between 1.5% and 2% over the duration of the project. And then we make 10% of the profit. So no profit, no compensation. It's a success-based compensation on the back end. And that's where we make the majority of our, we always think of our fee structure as keep the lights on and make sure you have the infrastructure to be able to do the job. And really you're making your money with the success of your investors.
For a qualified investor who has the assets to make this work, where does it make most sense in terms of their broader portfolio? RRSP, non-registered account, inside of a corp? What guidance would you have on that front?
Yeah, to me, it's a pretty simple one. RRSPs are a good one simply because duration and illiquidity being two of the sort of larger risks in our strategy. In an RSP, for most people, depending on what your age you're investing and what your investment objectives are, that's less of a factor if you're not accessing that cash or using it for something, right? Except for retirement, right? So as long as you're planning appropriately. The second place I think is definitely within a corporation. What we do is considered by tax authorities to be engaging in the business of development. So the benefit to that is it's considered active business income, the return. And therefore, it is treated as such within a corporation. So you have the ability to offset and defer because we're a limited partnership structure. So it gives you, if you think about what we're doing is on day one, you're buying something, you're spending a bunch of money to build it, sell it, and design it. And then you're getting the revenue recognition at the end. We flow through those losses. It gives people a tax deferral. So for example, physicians and people that have professional corporations, they can offset some of their interim income that's then recaptured. But it's a nice strategy. So I would say RSPs and corporations are the two most beneficial ways to invest.
Really interesting stuff. Sasha, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sasha Chouchou's CEO of Greybrook, and the topic of our conversation was investing in real estate in a way that doesn't require you have a plumbing wrench. Coming up next on Moolala, I'll speak with a financial therapist and coach about self-esteem. Aya Evans is our guest. Later, a mission that would have every high school student in the U.S. taking a one-semester course in personal finance before graduation. Tim Renzetta is co-founder of NextGen Personal Finance, and he's got more context about what he hopes to achieve by 2030. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can head on over to moolala.ca, listen to past episodes there. You can also search by name or topic, or go to any of the podcast platforms too, for that matter, Spotify, Amazon Prime, Apple Music, wherever you listen, download the full show, download a segment, write a review, maybe even subscribe so the next episode will arrive right on your device. Moolala, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. When you think about the term self-esteem, you can probably think of a lot of areas that that applies to: your dating life, your career, also your personal finances. It's quite relevant in your relationship to money. Yet I've never talked about that before. And today we're going to have that conversation. Our guest is Asia Evans. She is a financial therapist. She's very focused on looking at how self-esteem and improving self-esteem can impact a person's relationship with their money. She joins us from New York City. Hello there.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
I am great. How I came to hear about you was in the context of this phrase, self-esteem. And it isn't one that I've often woven into this broader conversation about money. Tell me how you define that word, because a part of me is like, wait a sec, do we still use that phrase? It seems very 1999 self-esteem. How do you define it?
I'm like, I certainly hope so. I can definitely tell you that there are a lot of therapists still using self-esteem. So, I mean, whatever we're using now, I want to know what we're calling it.
They would call it confidence. And I feel like there's a distinction. I don't know what it is.
They're different. I do think that they're different. Yeah.
So what's self-esteem?
So when I think about self-esteem, I think about how do you feel about yourself? So when you are, you know, putting your head down on your pillow, how do you think about yourself? How you showed up? What are the beliefs that you have about yourself? Now, when you have self-esteem, is it easier to be confident? Absolutely. But can people have confidence who have no self-esteem? Also, absolutely. It may not be that they believe it, though. So there are tons of people who outwardly can be really confident, but they don't feel good about themselves. When I'm talking about self-esteem, I'm talking about how do you feel about yourself? The innate value, do you believe it in what you bring to the world and to, you know, everybody else? Like, do you actually believe it?
In the absence of intention and a conversation with a qualified therapist such as yourself, where does self-esteem come from? What is already always there before we put our mind to dissecting it or analyzing?
Yeah, well, I think that's a very long answer, and we're trying to like smush it together to your point, but self-esteem, it can come from anything, right? And it comes from a lot of what were your childhood experiences. How did you start integrating the beliefs that you had about yourself? Where did they come from? Are those voices that you hear, whether they're positive or negative, are they yours? Are they somebody else's? And how did you start or come to really believing in your own capabilities, believing in the inherent value that you bring to the world and to anybody that you meet? So self-esteem to me is really about looking at how you think about yourself and then making sure that you are continuing to cultivate it. Because yes, I think if somebody was getting all of the positive messages in the world, then they are able to create a healthy self-esteem. But what happens when somebody is getting negative messages on a consistent basis? How do you heal from that and then move forward to a place that you can actually start integrating some positive views about yourself into your self-esteem?
So for those who have a low self-esteem for all sorts of reasons that can really put pressure and dampen that human's view of self, how does that manifest in terms of money? And I know there's not one answer. There's probably 1,000 answers. But what are some examples of where low self-esteem can show up on a bank statement somewhere?
Yeah. So a lot of people that I have worked with who are struggling with their self-esteem don't always know that their money behaviors may be tied to their self-esteem. So you may see somebody who is overspending. So it may be, hey, I'm shopping a lot. I am on social media apps and clicking the links and buying the things and seeing the outfits and seeing the cars and feeling like I need to have them too. And feeling like, hey, I would be valuable. I would be quote unquote perfect. I would be more on top of things if only I had insert material item here. When really what they're trying to do is feel better about themselves and increase the self-esteem. However, it's showing up in how they're spending money and how they're trying to cope with their self-esteem by spending money.
Yeah. So on the expense side, makes perfect sense. What about on the revenue side? Does it follow that someone with low self-esteem might be less willing to put themselves out there for the promotion and ask for the raise and do the make the career move or whatever?
Yep, definitely. For a lot of people, it's almost a way of avoiding their money to just be like, no, I can't put myself out there. No, I don't believe that I can do it, which yes, comes back to self-esteem. But if you're putting yourself in a position of, you know, like you said, a promotion or a bigger, more present role at work, that may feel like too much and really impede on somebody's ability to kind of like move past where they think that they can be. So I don't believe in myself to be able to get to that point. Who am I to even believe that I could take on that promotion or that extra work? And that can then start mixing in with imposter syndrome and just kind of figuring out how or if they can move forward at all in the role. So yeah, it definitely plays a role.
It makes perfect sense in on both revenue and expenses. In a therapeutic context, how do you help a client think in those terms? How do you hold the mirror up for them such that there's insight available that could perhaps alter behavior?
Sure. So when I'm working with my clients, and majority of the clients that I work with now are financial therapy clients, so I'm really walking them through a process. So when I see them, and this is, I'm clinically trained, I have my master's in counseling psychology, so I am providing therapy. So yeah. In that vein, we are beginning not with what their money looks like right now, but more so what they grew up thinking. What was money like? How did it look with their families? How was it talked about with their families as they were growing up? What are the roots of their money beliefs? So I really want to get in tapped into how did they start believing what they believe about money from the beginning? And in that story, that's when we're able to also have conversations about their self-esteem. How did they feel about themselves? What was coming up for a lot of people? And it's very age appropriate when we're in middle school or in high school, a lot of times like showing up with a cool outfit or showing up with quality shoes, sneakers, you know, whatever the kids are into at that time can be really, really important socially. So sometimes that is kind of a window into what they were experiencing in terms of their self-esteem building, how they were looked at, how they saw themselves, and then what they would do with their money in the future.
I'm sure you see this on a continuum, that there are people who had like a hard time growing up and then other people who suffered real trauma and that manifests in a financial way frequently for them. What is the access to the healing of trauma or the resolution of things that have happened in the past?
So I think that, I mean, while I would love it if everybody had access to therapy, that would be fantastic. I know that that is not the case. So getting to a point of understanding what the traumatic event was, or understanding where they're at in the process of it. So not everybody who has trauma needs to be coming to see a financial therapist, of course, right? So making sure that you're seeing the appropriate provider for what you are trying to look for, or as you're having these conversations and uncovering what was going on for you, making sure that then you have the right referral to who you need to see. So if somebody is seeing me and we're also talking about, hey, this came up in my childhood and this was really traumatic, that's going to be really important in how they're able to heal and what they are trying to heal from, and recognizing some of those wounds that may be there. So people getting to be honest with themselves is going to be really important, and then deciding where do they want to end up. So for me, although I am trauma-informed, have a lot of education, a lot of training in trauma, that is not where my wheelhouse is. So I mostly focus on people's financial traumas and what they went through and how that impacts what their money behaviors are today. But I am totally comfortable saying, hey, this sounds really traumatic, that event that you went through, whether it was some abuse, whether that was physical or emotional, it sounds like that's also something that's coming up for you. And I want to make sure that you have an outside therapist who's going to focus on that solely to help you walk through that, because I'm going to help you walk through what's going on with your money and how it's impacting your financial behaviors.
It would seem like there's a part of this, this topic of self-esteem that is the same generations and generations and generations and generations into our past. And there seems like there's a part of it that is so of the moment because of the stimulus that we expose ourselves to online and social media in particular. Can you talk a little bit about the moment that we're in and how that affects self-esteem in a way that it might not have 20 years ago?
Definitely. I think social media is a huge culprit of that, for the good and the bad that it brings to people. I don't think that all social media is bad. I do think that there is a sense of community that people can have when you are on social, when you are seeing other people who have lived through or experienced or are talking about similar things that you're interested in. That is a beautiful thing. However, when we can swing the pendulum the other side is when comparison starts, when it starts to feel like, hey, look at that person's beautiful granite countertops and their house and their car and their clothes and their life and their weight, and they're so beautiful. And I look at myself and I feel less than. I look at what I have and it doesn't look like I'll ever look successful, quote unquote, when we don't know the other story of the person who's online. We don't know the story of the content creator. We don't know where their money's coming from. So it's really easy to get caught up in the comparison game and feeling like you are less than, or what you have or what your life looks like is less than somebody else, because it is constant, to your point, and it's starting younger and younger. And that's really impactful.
Really interesting. I really appreciate your perspective on this topic, Asia. It's a new way of thinking, a new way of talking about money that we haven't addressed before. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Asia Evans is a financial therapist. She joined us to talk about self-esteem and the intersection between that notion and our behavior in the area of money. She was in New York City. Coming up later on the show, we'll talk about something called Mission 2030. NextGen Personal Finance co-founder Tim Renzetta will be here to talk about a plan to introduce personal finance to high school students. But first, is your to-do list at home way longer than your spouse's to-do list? Or maybe it's the other way around. Author Eve Rodsky talks about how we can make things a little bit more balanced with something she calls the fair play method. If you're looking for some books to help you get focused on personal finances, I've written a couple myself. They are available on Amazon, on Indigo, in the bookstore, at the library. The first is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place, Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
All right, couples out there, whose responsibility is it to take out the garbage, to cook dinner, to pick up the kids from their activities? When you think about all of the things that there are to do, all of those tasks, is there equality? Is there an imbalance? Is it more for them or more for you? This question of how to balance household tasks can be overwhelming. It can be frustrating. It can cause a tremendous amount of stress, but maybe it doesn't have to. Eve Rodsky came up with something called the Fair Play Method, which is both a book and a board game. And we're going to talk about it now. Eve joins us from Los Angeles. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
So the personal finance spin here is time is money. And while I know that is an oversimplification of all the work you have done to bring your method to life, let's start there. How do you frame this in the context of personal finance?
Wow. Well, let's just say that there's three toxic words, Bruce, that I think a lot of people bring to their home or when they start to become a couple and they're looking at their own personal finances and combining finances. And that is, we're going to figure it out. Nobody ever figures anything out. And so if you, instead of figuring out what that means is you're going to go back on assumptions as opposed to structured decision-making. And that can be really, really bad for your personal finances because you think you're making decisions for the couple, Bruce, out of love. And actually the home is your most important organization and Fair Play is there to help you make that organization more efficient, more productive, and have a lot more grace and humor and generosity when you make those decisions.
Which we so need. You begin with this story that resonates with a lot of parents, probably mostly women. You reference 30 phone calls and 46 texts that you and your friends received from the partner at home who you had like this one moment to be outside of the house and they couldn't get it together. Can you briefly set the scene for us?
Absolutely. So I talk about my life sort of before Fair Play and after. And I think before Fair Play, I was one of those, we'll figure it out. Having children is an act of love, you know, even though I'm a lawyer. So I sort of laugh because I for my living, Bruce, I work for families that look like the HBO show Succession. Right. And you should feel bad for me because what I do for those families is I do bring that grace and humor and generosity to their most complex organizational and financial decisions. And one day we can do a whole episode on that.
Yeah.
But my own home, I wasn't treating as an organization. And so what happened was there was a time in my life where I let those assumptions get the better of me, where I said to myself, in the time it takes me to tell my husband, Seth, what to do, I should do it myself. I said to myself, my husband makes more money than me, even though, by the way, I'm more highly educated than him. But my husband makes more money than me, so I should do all the unpaid labor in the house. And what it culminated in was a breast cancer march where we were honoring a friend who had been recently diagnosed. And there were 10 women, not all married to men. But I say that at noon of that breast cancer march, we had this wonderful Saturday morning, all covered in glitter and pink. And at noon, we turned into the reverse of Cinderella. We turned into pumpkins because every single one of us married to a man started to get texts like, where did you put Hudson's soccer bag? Yeah. What's the address of the birthday party? Did you leave me a gift? My favorite, Bruce, was my friend Kate's husband. He texted us, God help him. Do the kids need to eat lunch?
No, it's a new thing we're trying. It's called starving the children.
Let's starve the children, right? I mean, what made this so funny, not only that we had 30 phone calls and 46 texts for 10 women over 30 minutes, but exactly, Bruce, what you just said. The amount of time is money in this conversation, the fact that this has happened, kids eating lunch had probably happened in their household thousands of times, but you still have to ask that question means that you lose efficiency and your time is being used to make decisions where you can make those decisions in advance. That's what a system is. And so Fair Play tells you your time is money. You want more of your time not to be hijacked by what your kids need to eat for lunch. Make those decisions in advance with your partner and don't just quote unquote figure it out.
I read the book, but you also have cards and the cards include a whole bunch of S, you do stuff you do. Yes. Maybe a different word could be substituted in there on a radio station where you were allowed to swear. How long a list was that after you finished finished compiling it? Hundreds of items? I don't even know.
Well, again, Bruce, what I had heard before I decided to look at this through the legal sort of behavior design lens that I use for my clients to help them make decisions, I was told the only advice that was out there before Fair Play was make a list or divorce, which is very expensive, as I've heard from your other episodes. And I know from my single mother household. So making a list is what I started. Fair Play is not a list. Lists alone don't work. Systems do. When you understand what a system means, how to own tasks, how to be a partner in them. But it did start as a list. And just so you know, the Fair Play cards, which was started as the, as you said, stuff I do spreadsheet, yes, had 98 tabs in Excel and over 2,000 items of invisible work. Now, they are now evolved into the 100 cards that I ask partners or even roommates or polyamorous relationships to discuss in advance and practice these communication skills. However, what I think is important for your show, especially, is that, again, people look at these decisions around bringing children into the home, moving, with a lot of emotion, whether it's love, excitement, trepidation, instead of looking at through a financial lens. When you don't have children, there are 60 cards that all have an expense to them that are part of your home organization. When you add a child into the home, you are adding 40 cards, everything from childcare helpers. What are your babysitters going to look like? What are your nannies going to look like? Are you going to pay your mother to watch your kids? Cleaning gets so much more intense. Dishes get more intense because you're boiling bottles. Your garbage is more intense because now you have diaper pails. Groceries are more expensive. Home furnishings, you need to buy cribs and rocking chairs. Home goods and supplies, are you kidding? Diapers are so intensively expensive. Home maintenance, a lot of people want to put an addition on their house. Yeah. Home purchase, mortgage and insurance. People usually want to move. Hosting gets more intense. So people are not looking at the cards necessarily or these lists with the practical nature of the fact that each one of these cards comes with an expense. And I think that's a very, very important part of the puzzle in deciding whether you want to have kids.
You've got four rules. The Fair Play Method has four rules. The first one is all time is created equal. And I think you probably have heard a lot of pushback on that in two-income households where one person makes six figures and the other person makes something maybe sufficiently less than that. How do you square that circle?
In 10 years, when people and relationships have looked as time is money, I assume you do more of the unpaid labor in the household that we just talked about because you make less or because your job is more flexible. We have seen those relationships not be stable relationships. We've seen resentment. We've seen anger. We've seen divorce. We've seen circumstances change. People will think that sort of division of labor, maybe that gendered division of labor would be the most stable because we saw it in the Leave It to Beaver era as mom stays home with the apron and dad goes with his briefcase to work. But we found over 10 years that that is not a stable relationship because unfortunately, again, those assumptions about time being money, you should do more because you work less or you are paid less. Don't work. What happens to a relationship is much better, regardless of money. If you say, yes, you may end up doing more labor, but I value your time as much as my time. And we're going to figure it out. So there's perceived fairness for both of us. And that works for every relationship, including work relationships too.
I've heard I'm going to use air quotes here, the male side of the conversation where the male earns significantly more and it especially an issue in high income families where they will say, just throw money at it. Just throw money at it. You don't need to be there all the time. You don't need to pick up the kids from school. And often, whether there's a gender dynamic or not, there are different values about how we show up as parents and how it's like actually really important for me to pick up my own kid at school. Sometimes I'm not going to throw money at that. How do you reconcile the values delta?
That's such a beautiful question. And I do that very intentionally because that was one of the most toxic things we heard, especially from women, that their partners were saying, well, if you're so overwhelmed, just get help. The way that they were hearing that is if you're so overwhelmed, don't bring it to me, just deal with it with somebody else. So what we did in the Fair Play deck is we actually divided up the 100 cards into four suits, Bruce. And by the way, every one of these has an expense. So I want you to understand that even we have home and we have something called out, which is like you said, transporting your kids to school, buying the groceries, the meals. But there are actually two suits in the Fair Play deck called caregiving and magic, where they are not outsourceable. So even if you said, I want to outsource my entire child rearing years to, you know, a million nannies, there's still 50 cards out there where typically we see, even in high income families, people are not outsourcing. And I'll give you an example. As much as you love Alexia, Bruce, she's not going to decide. And that could be, you know, that make up a name for a nanny. She's not going to be deciding whether or not your child's adenoids are being taken out. Right. She's not taking your child to get a haircut. She's not bringing the flowers to your child at a recital. And so I think it's really, really important for people to understand that the outsourcing debate has to end, because even if you could outsource, there are still 50 tasks that were identified in our research that people were not outsourcing that still have to be dealt with.
Now, I love the method. The method is super clear. It is precise. It marries the perfect intersection of both practicality and reality. What do you do when your spouse doesn't want to play?
It's a great question. What I like to say is that there's a secret formula in the home. And that secret formula is boundaries, systems, and communication. And it comes up because I was listening to you. I hear communication failures all the time in some of your other episodes when it comes to money. And boundary failures as well. This idea that I did not expect to be doing all of this, and then somehow my life turned into this, right? We don't want that. That leads to people perceiving less happiness. And so what I would say is you want to address where the friction is coming from. If you tell me that you've only discussed the division of labor in your house once in 2005, and you want to tell me that, oh, you can never bring this up again, that's going to be like you going to your doctor and saying, I'm fit. I can tell you my heart is healthy because I exercised once in 2005. So typically when people are reluctant to bring this up, or somebody is resistant to come to the table, it's because they've had communication failures in the past where other difficult conversations have not gone well. So I like to say, assess where you're lacking. Typically, it's going to probably be communication if you're reluctant to come to the table, and then start practicing that first before you just bring up something, you know, like fair play or any other conversation like money.
Yeah.
Practice your communication. If I'm married to Bruce, instead of saying I'm talking to Bruce today because I have to tell him to pick up our kids, I want you to wake up and say, I'm going to start thinking about communication as not transactional, but relational. I'm going to talk to Bruce today just to figure out how to better talk to Bruce in the future.
Right.
Maybe Bruce needs me to talk to him in the morning because he's not a night person. And when I wake him up, when he's sleeping, he doesn't want to hear about the urgent matter in the morning. Maybe Bruce likes a drink before we bring up a difficult conversation. Everybody, it doesn't mean you have to walk on eggshells. I'm not saying you have to do the emotional labor of managing someone else, but everybody who's good at communication tells me the secret that they actually practice communication. Yeah.
Really interesting stuff. Well, you give a very clear and compelling song sheet for people to practice with. And I thank you for joining us to talk about it today.
Thanks so much.
Eve Rodsky is the author of The Fair Play Method. That's the book, but there's also these great cards. It is such a simple method that makes complete and total sense. So I really encourage you to check it out. Coming up, making personal finance a priority in high schools. Tim Ranzetta, co-founder of Next Gen Personal Finance, is on a mission. He calls it Mission 2030. And to stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can sign up to our newsletter. It's got all the latest things that we've done on CBC Radio and CityLine and BNN and SiriusXM and all that. Just go to moolala.ca. Are you struggling with debt? Feeling like no matter what you do, you just can't get on top of it? Maybe you're nervous, but feeling like you're almost ready to take control of your financial future. Introducing Credit Canada Goal, an innovative, holistic financial coaching program designed to help you get out of debt and back into life. Credit Canada Goal takes place virtually over 6 weeks and includes live class sessions, group coaching, homework, and an accountability buddy. It's intense, but the results are amazing. And if you're accepted into the program, your tuition is covered by a scholarship, so it won't cost you a thing. Visit creditcanada.com/gold to learn more and apply for one of our upcoming programs. Take control and transform your financial future with Credit Canada Gold. We know about the importance of financial literacy. You know about the importance of financial literacy because you're watching and listening to this right now. And I think there is consensus that there is a real value in teaching our kids this stuff and teaching our kids this stuff early. However, in our culture across North America, most personal finance education is left to parents, not teachers. And so you can imagine how inconsistent those lessons are, given that every family is so different. One advocate based in the US believes there is a real importance to having consistent personal finance education across America and is advocating for that to be included in the curriculum and a requirement for graduation. Our guest is Tim Renzetta. He is the co-founder of Next Gen Personal Finance, and he joins us from Burlingame, California. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Great to be with you today.
Make the case that personal finance should be mandatory in schools. You don't graduate if you didn't pass that course.
You said it already. Not everybody is. We got an unequal playing field, folks. Not everybody's getting it at home. And if you believe the surveys, if we don't educate, well, guess who will? Social media. Mm. So we know about 70% of young people are getting financial advice from social media. And without a personal finance course to help them discern what's good advice versus bad. And then just think about all the decisions that young people are thrust into making when they're in high school, right? What are they going to do after high school? Is it a career? Is it trade school? Is it a two-year college, a four-year college? Well, let's tally up the costs and the benefits of each of those. They may start using credit cards. They have the keys to the car, so they better understand auto insurance policies. And they may have a part-time job, and there's so much wrapped around that, right? How to read a pay stub, pay taxes, understand what soft skills mean and why they're so valuable. There's so much to cover that an optimal time to teach it, the sooner the better, but a capstone course before they go off into the real world.
Here in Canada, our education is structured by province largely, and some provinces have it built into the curriculum, others don't. There's certainly real inconsistency in terms of delivery. Do you believe it should be one course, the same course delivered uniformly by school boards across America, or would they customize according to the populations in which they serve?
Absolutely the latter. It needs to be customized. Nobody knows their students better than the educators. And so when we started Next Gen Personal Finance almost a decade ago, we created curriculum that teachers can customize. They can just make a copy of our existing curriculum and make changes, add questions, delete questions, really tailor it to their audience. Because ultimately, I mean, even when you look at a class, when you look at one class, I mean, we've heard teachers say this, you can have the gamut of folks who parents might be living paycheck to paycheck and others who are doing extremely well. And so it really takes a level of sensitivity also on this topic, unlike any other, I think, where an educator will know best how to deliver these lessons to students.
I agree with this as a general idea, but I will weave into our conversation a yeah, but. And the yeah, but that I would weave in here is home economics. So it was a mandatory course for all of us in middle school, grade 7-8 here in Canada. And it did very little to encourage me to cook at home. I could make, I don't know, spaghetti or whatever. What encouraged me was my mom saying, I'm at work. You make dinner or there is no dinner. How did those two things come together? The theory of the classroom and the practice of what happens in the home.
Yeah, I mean, the great part about this is we've seen examples of teachers engaging parents. How do they do it? They send a newsletter home to the parents identifying what's being covered in the classroom. Because we know the reason many parents don't talk about this is they don't feel confident in their own financial situation. And the reason I'm so passionate about this, it was about 12, 13 years ago, I volunteered to teach a course at a high school in East Palo Alto, California, that was serving students who were trying to be first in their family to go to college. And what I saw there was not only a level of engagement with the students that was unprecedented, but also I started to hear from parents. And so there's a very real ripple effect, multi-generational, when you educate students, they bring these lessons home. So that's the argument I would make. And you need to make sure you're incorporating family, you know, because the family is going to have certain values. The family has thought about money in a certain way. So one of our first lessons is addressing that issue front and center. How are you learning about money? Because whether parents talk about it or not, guess what? Young people are keen observers.
Oh, 100%. 100%. How I would frame it is there's three kind of influences to how a human behaves. There is the knowledge, which can be taught. There's skills, which can be taught and modeled. But then there's the norms of the household. So how do you overcome the reality that a lot of these kids learn all these great lessons about don't carry credit card debt, and they go home and mom or dad says, you know what, I'm tired. Let's order in Uber Eats, despite the fact that that credit card's got, you know, a couple grand outstanding on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult one, right? Because there is this behavior gap between what we know should happen and what we actually do. And I think the best we can do is really have students analyze that, have them think about behaviors, not only their own behaviors, but maybe what they're observing in the household, because it is tricky. But what we find is the sooner we can get young people this information, I remember, for example, showing the students I was teaching a credit card disclosure, and that's called the Schumer box in the US. And they go and look at it. I don't need to say anything. They just look at it and they say, there's a lot of fees. Wow, what's this interest rate? What is prime plus 16 or 18 make? And then they hear that and they're like, you know, we can actually change people's attitudes when we give them the information. And so I just walked away from that session feeling like, you know what, students are going to know when they get a credit card, there's a lot of risk inherent in that. So don't spend what you don't have.
Your ambition is bold. It is a plan that would affect hundreds of millions of people over the course of years. What will it take for you to bring this to life, for this actually to be a reality in the, I don't know, 6 years you have left?
Well, there's incredible momentum. You mentioned kind of people saying, well, this is not being taught in schools. We hit a tipping point in the US. Just this year, we can now say 53% of high school students are taking the course today before they graduate, or will in the next 2 to 3 years. That's just based on legislation that's taken place in states. So we've gone from basically a situation in the US where 8 states required this 3 years ago. Today it's 25. And so there's a tremendous movement. I think people are awake to the fact that without this information, young people are going to learn through the school of hard knocks, or they're going to learn from social media. They deserve a course. And I guess the reason I think it's happening in the US, teachers and students are front and center in the vanguard, kind of making this happen. Because when they speak to legislators and say, here's what's happening in my classroom, or here's what's happening in my life, young people not just taking in this knowledge, but acting upon it. I know classrooms where teachers are posting bulletin boards of all the students signing up for Roth IRAs, thinking about retirement. And people say, young people don't think 10 minutes ahead. How can you ever get them to think to the future? They do it. They have found effective ways to get students to think about their future selves.
Yeah, so they got them to think about compound interest in a way that was relevant and meaningful for them.
Absolutely.
How do you address the tension between financial behavior that serves your future self and the reality of being a human on the planet today, which is one of enormous access to credit and an enormous consumer push on things that you clearly need in order for you to survive the day, either what you eat, drink, or where you travel. There's real tension there.
Absolutely. I mean, we spend a lot of time talking about psychology because we're not necessarily wired. We're wired to kind of survive in the savannah, not necessarily in a consumer-driven economy. So the first step is just awareness. Recognize when you're having that feeling, when you're looking at social media of somebody enjoying a great vacation, wearing a great pair of shoes, having the latest in fashion, realizing that you're experiencing this thing called FOMO, fear of missing out. So let's call it what it is. Let's have a conversation. Let's think about it. And you know, the best advice I've heard is a pause, right? Before you purchase something, put it in a shopping cart, wait a day, wait a week. Do I really need this item? Because you're right, we're drenched in consumerism. And so let's also teach them alternatives, like the FIRE movement, right? Whether you agree with the retire early part, this idea of financial independence, let's look at the other side of people who are being incredibly frugal. Not saying that that's the right path either, but let's show them alternative ways to live, because otherwise, if all they know is kind of what they experience around them, yes, it's easy to get dragged into it.
One last question before we go here. I think every parent had said of the generation that follows, Kids these days are so fill in the blank. But as a parent of a 14-year-old, one of the things I observe is a level of entitlement around material things that just wasn't the same for me as a Gen Xer. But I bet this was a complaint my parents had about my generation too. How do you weave that into curriculum when it's really not about knowledge? It's about a paradigm or a mindset.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about what you're seeing. I've got a 14-year-old too, so I'm always interested.
Yeah, well, they want what they want, but there's also a belief that they should have what they want. And I don't know what the stats are in America, but in Canada, 14-year-olds don't work like 14-year-olds worked when I was a kid. We all had jobs. We all babysat. We all had paper routes. I sound like I'm Little House on the Prairie here, but it's a very different time for our kids than it was for me as a Gen Xer.
Yeah, I think an exercise teachers tell us can be really effective around that is creating a budget for your life post high school or post college.
Because when it's on you, when it's all on you.
It's exactly. And so you can see, you know, you choose a major that may lead to a salary and then you create a budget. What does it mean to live independently? What does it mean to have an apartment, to have a vehicle or transportation? What does it mean to have a food budget? Think through all of those things that might be coming through the bank of mom and dad. And then there's an awakening, like resources are not unlimited. The idea that I can take an entry-level job and live in the city of my dreams in my own one-bedroom apartment and have the souped-up sports car, probably not a reality. And so teachers don't let students leave that exercise without balancing their budget.
Really interesting stuff. Tim, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Bruce.
Tim Renzetta is co-founder of NextGen Personal Finance, and he is on a mission. It is called Mission 2030, and it is an effort to ensure that high school graduates in the U.S. will complete a personal finance course before they graduate. That's it for our show today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Feedback on the show, please send it your way, your thoughts, your questions, your story ideas to reach us. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. Another thing you could do as you move on to the next thing in your day is sign up for the Moolala newsletter. You can do so at moolala.ca. And also, you know, this show's a podcast too. Go to any of the podcast platforms and subscribe, maybe even renew. On social media, I am @BruceSelry on X, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.